but because of events that flowed or did not flow from their accomplishments. The hypothetical teacher subtly changed the ground rules for Da Gama, but they changed right back for De Soto. In this way, students learn that black feats are not considered important while white ones are. Continuing down the list of likely pre-Columbian explorations, we arrive at an interesting vantage point from which to consider this debate. Let's compare two other possible pre-Columbian expeditions, from the west coasts of Africa and Ireland. When Columbus reached Haiti, he found the Arawaks in possession of some spear points made of guanine. The Indians said they got them from black traders who had come from the south and east. Guanine proved to be an alloy of gold, silver, and copper, identical to the gold alloy preferred by West Africans, who also called it guanine. Islamic historians have recorded stories of voyages west from Mali in West Africa around 1311, during the reign of Mansa Bakari II. From time to time in the 14th and 15th centuries, shipwrecked African vessels, remnants, presumably, of transatlantic trade, washed up on Cape Verde. From contacts in West Africa, the Portuguese heard that African traders were visiting Brazil in the mid-1400s. This knowledge may have influenced Portugal to insist on moving the Pope's line of demarcation further west in the Treaty of Tordesillas, 1494. Traces of diseases common in Africa have been detected in pre-Columbian corpses in Brazil. Columbus's son Ferdinand, who accompanied the admiral on his third voyage, reports that people they met or heard about in eastern Honduras are almost black in color, ugly in aspect, probably Africans. The first Europeans to reach Panama, Balboa and company, reported seeing black slaves in an Indian town. Indians said they had captured them from a nearby black community. Oral history from Afro-Mexicans contains tales of pre-Columbian crossings from West Africa. In all, then, data from diverse sources suggest that pre-Columbian voyages from West Africa to America were probable. In contrast, the evidence for an Irish trip to America comes from only one side of the Atlantic. Irish legends written in the 9th or 10th century tell of an abbot and 17 monks who journeyed to the promised land of the saints during a 7-year sojourn in a leather boat centuries earlier. The stories include details that are literally fabulous. Each Easter, the priest and his crew supposedly conducted mass on the back of a whale. They visited a pillar of crystal, perhaps an iceberg, and an island of fire. We cannot simply dismiss these legends, however. When the Norse first reached Iceland, Irish monks were living on the island, whose volcanoes could have provided the island of fire. How do American history textbooks treat these two sets of legendary voyagers? 5 of the textbooks admit the possibility of an Irish expedition. The Challenge of Freedom gives the fullest account. Some people believe that Irish missionaries may have sailed to the Americas hundreds of years before the first voyages of Columbus. According to Irish legends, Irish monks sailed the Atlantic Ocean in order to bring Christianity to the people they met. One Irish legend in particular tells about a land southwest of the Azores. This land was supposedly discovered by St. Brendan, an Irish missionary, about 500 A.D. Not one textbook mentions the West Africans, however. While leaving out Columbus's predecessors, American history books continue to make mistakes when they get to the last discoverer. They present cut-and-dried answers, mostly glorifying Columbus, always avoiding uncertainty or controversy. Often their errors seem to be copied from other textbooks. Let me repeat the collective Columbus story they tell. Born in Genoa, of humble parents, Christopher Columbus grew up to become an experienced seafarer, venturing as far as Iceland and West Africa. His adventures convinced him that the world must be round, and that the fabled riches of the East, spices and gold, could be had by sailing west, superseding the overland routes, which the Turks had closed off to commerce. To get funding for his enterprise, he beseeched monarch after monarch in Western Europe. After at first being dismissed by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, Columbus finally got his chance when Isabella decided to underwrite a modest expedition. Columbus outfitted three pitifully small ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and set forth from Spain. After an arduous journey of more than 2 months, during which his mutinous crew almost threw him overboard, Columbus discovered the West Indies on October 12, 1492. Unfortunately, although he made three more voyages to America, he never knew he had discovered a new world. Columbus died in obscurity, unappreciated and penniless. Yet without his daring, American history would have been very different. For in a sense, he made it all possible. Textbooks get the date right, and the names of the ships. Most of the rest that they tell us is untrustworthy. Many aspects of Columbus's life remain a mystery. He claimed to be from Genoa, Italy, and there is evidence that he was. There is also evidence that he wasn't. Columbus didn't seem to be able to write in Italian, even when writing to people in Genoa. Some historians believe he was Jewish, a converso, or convert to Christianity, probably from Spain. Spain was pressuring its Jews to convert to Christianity or leave the country. He may have been a Genoese Jew. Still other historians claimed he was from Corsica, Portugal, or elsewhere. What about Columbus's social class background? One textbook tells us he was poor, the son of a poor Genoese weaver, while another assures us he was rich, the son of a prosperous wool weaver. Each is certain, but people who have spent years studying Columbus say we cannot be sure. We don't even know for certain where Columbus thought he was going. Evidence suggests he was seeking Japan, India, and Indonesia. Other evidence indicates he was trying to reach new lands to the west. Historians have asserted each viewpoint for centuries, because India was known for its great wealth, Las Casas points out. It was in Columbus's interest to induce the monarchs, always doubtful about his enterprise, to believe him when he said he was setting out in search of a western route to India. After reviewing the evidence, Columbus's recent biographer, Kirkpatrick Sale, concluded, "We will likely never know for sure." Sale noted that such a conclusion is not very satisfactory for those who demand certainty in their historical tales. Predictably, all our textbooks are of this type. All know he was seeking Japan and the West Indies. Thus, authors keep their readers from realizing that historians do not know all the answers. Hence, history is not just a process of memorizing them. The extent to which textbooks sometimes disagree, particularly when each seems so certain of what it declares, can be pretty scary. What was the weather like during Columbus's 1492 trip? According to Land of Promise, his ships were storm-battered, but American Adventures says they enjoyed peaceful seas. How long was the voyage? After more than 2 months at sea, according to the Challenge of Freedom, the crew saw land. But the American Adventure says the voyage lasted nearly a month. What were the Americas like when Columbus arrived? Thickly peopled, in one book quoting Columbus, thinly spread, according to another. To make a better myth, American culture has perpetuated the idea that Columbus was boldly forging ahead while everyone else, even his own crew, imagined the world was flat. The American Pageant is the only textbook that still repeats this hoax. The superstitious sailors grew increasingly mutinous, according to Pageant, because they were fearful of sailing over the edge of the world. In truth, Few people on both sides of the Atlantic believed in 1492 that the world was flat. Most Europeans and Native Americans knew the world to be round. It looks round. It casts a circular shadow on the moon. Sailors see its roundness when ships disappear over the horizon. Hull first, then sails. Washington Irving wins credit for popularizing the flat earth fable in 1828. In his best-selling biography of Columbus, Irving described Columbus's supposed defense of his round earth theory before the flat earth savants at Salamanca University. Irving himself surely knew the story to be fiction. He probably thought it added a nice dramatic flourish and would do no harm. But it does. It invites us to believe that the primitives of the world, admittedly including pre-Columbian Europeans, had only a crude understanding of the planet they lived on, until aided by a forward-thinking European. It also turns Columbus into a man of science who corrected our faulty geography. Intense debunking of the flat earth legend by professional historians has made an impact. Yet even the 11 textbooks that don't repeat Irving's fiction choose wholly ineffectual words to counter it. This passage from Triumph of the American Nation exemplifies the problem. Convinced that the earth was round, a knowledge shared by many informed people of the day, Columbus believed that if he sailed far enough to the west, he would reach Asia. To be sure, the minor subordinate clause quietly notes that not everyone, perhaps not even most people, believed in flat earth geography. But the main subordinate clause and the primary clause emphasize Columbus's own belief that the earth was round. The sentence makes little sense unless the reader infers that Columbus's belief was unusual. I have talked not only with students, but also with teachers who have read textbooks like Triumph without noticing this point. Thus, teachers often still believe and still relay to their students the flat earth legend. Even the death of Columbus has been changed to make a better story. Having Columbus come to a tragic end, sick, poor, and ignorant of his great accomplishment, adds melodramatic interest. Columbus's discoveries were not immediately appreciated by the Spanish government, according to The American Adventure. He died in neglect in 1506. In fact, Spain immediately appreciated Columbus's discoveries, which is why they immediately outfitted him for a much larger second voyage. In 1499, Columbus made a major gold strike on Haiti. He and his successors then forced hundreds of thousands of Indians to mine the gold for them. Money from the Americas continued to flow into Columbus and Spain. Perhaps not what he felt he deserved, but enough to keep all wolves far from his door. Columbus died well off and left his heirs well endowed, even with the title Admiral of the Ocean Sea, now carried by his 18th generation descendant. Moreover, Columbus's own journal shows clearly that he knew he had reached a new continent. The errors textbooks make about Columbus don't result simply from sloppy scholarship. Textbooks want to magnify Columbus as a great hero, a man of vision, energy, resourcefulness, and courage, in the words of the American pageant. Some of the details the textbook authors pile on are harmless, I suppose, such as the fabrications about Isabella's sending a messenger galloping after Columbus and pawning her jewels to pay for the expedition. All of the enhancements humanize Columbus, however, to induce readers to identify with him. Here is a passage from Land of Promise. It is October 1492. Three small, storm-battered ships are lost at sea, sailing into an unknown ocean. A frightened crew has been threatening to throw their stubborn captain overboard, turn the ships around, and make for the safety of familiar shores. Then, a miracle. The sailors see some green branches floating on the water. Land birds fly overhead. From high in the ship's rigging, the lookout cries, "Land! Land ahead!" Fears turn to joy. Soon the grateful captain wades ashore and gives thanks to God. Now, really, the Nina, the Pinta, and Santa Maria were not storm-battered. To make a better myth, the textbook authors want the voyage to seem harder than it was, so they invent bad weather. Columbus's own journal reveals that the three ships enjoyed lovely sailing. Seas were so calm that for days at a time sailors were able to converse from one ship to another. Indeed, the only time they experienced even moderately high seas was on the last day, when they knew they were near land. To make a better myth, to make the trip seem longer than it was, most of the textbooks overlook Columbus's stopover in the Canary Islands. The voyage across the unknown Atlantic took 1 month, not two. To make a better myth, the textbooks describe Columbus's ships as tiny and inefficient, when actually these three vessels were fully suited to his purpose, as naval author Pietro Barazzi has pointed out. To make a better myth, 6 of 12 textbooks exaggerate the crew's complaints into a near mutiny. The primary sources differ. Some claim the sailors threatened to go back home if they didn't reach land soon. Other sources claim that Columbus lost heart and that the captains of the other two ships persuaded him to keep on. Still other sources suggest that the three leaders met and agreed to continue on for a few more days and then reassess the situation. After studying the matter, Columbus's biographer, Samuel Eliot Morison, reduced the complaints to mere griping. They were all getting on each other's nerves, as happens even nowadays. So much for the crew's threat to throw Columbus overboard. Such exaggeration is not entirely harmless. Another archetype lurks below the surface, that those who direct social enterprises are more intelligent than those nearer the bottom. Bill Bigelow, a high school history teacher, has pointed out that the sailors are stupid, superstitious, cowardly, and sometimes scheming. Columbus, on the other hand, is brave, wise, and godly. These portrayals amount to an anti-working-class, pro-boss polemic. Indeed, the only textbook that still repeats the old flat earth myth thinks badly of the sailors, whom it characterizes as a motley crew. False entries in the log of the Santa Maria constitute another piece of the myth. Columbus was a true leader, says A History of the United States. He altered the records of distances they had covered so the crew wouldn't think they had gone too far from home. Salvador de Madariaga has persuasively argued that to believe this, we would have to think the others on the voyage were fools. Columbus had no special method available only to him, whereby distances sailed could be more accurately reckoned than by the other pilots and masters. Indeed, Columbus was less experienced as a navigator than the Pinzon brothers, who captained the Nina and the Pinta. During the return voyage, Columbus confided in his journal the real reason for the false log entries. He wanted to keep the route to the Indies secret. As paraphrased by Las Casas, he says that he pretended to have gone a greater distance in order to confound the pilots and sailors who did the charts, that he might remain master of that route to the Indies. To make a better myth, our textbooks find space for many other humanizing particulars. They have the lookout cry, Tierra, or land. Most of them tell us that Columbus's first act after going ashore was thanking God for leading them safely across the sea, even though the surviving summary of Columbus's own journal states only that before them all he took possession of the island, as in fact he did, for the king and queen, his sovereigns. Many of the textbooks tell of Columbus's three later voyages to the Americas, but they don't find space to tell us how Columbus treated the lands and the people he discovered. Christopher Columbus introduced two phenomena that revolutionized race relations and transformed the modern world: the taking of land, wealth, and labor from indigenous peoples, leading to their near extermination, and the transatlantic slave trade, which created a racial underclass. Columbus's initial impression of the Arawaks, who inhabited most of the islands in the Caribbean, was quite favorable. He wrote in his journal on October 13, 1492, "At daybreak great multitudes of men came to the shore, all young and of fine shapes and very handsome. Their hair was not curly, but loose and coarse, like horsehair. All have foreheads much broader than any people I have hitherto seen. Their eyes are large and very beautiful. They are not black, but the color of the inhabitants of the Canaries." This reference to the Canaries was ominous, for Spain was then in the process of exterminating the aboriginal people of those islands. Columbus went on to describe the Arawak's canoes, some large enough to contain 40 or 45 men. Finally, he got down to business. "I was very attentive to them, and strove to learn if they had any gold. Seeing some of them with little bits of metal hanging at their noses, I gathered from them by signs that by going southward, or steering around the island in that direction, there would be found a king who possessed great cups full of gold. At dawn the next day, Columbus sailed to the other side of the island, probably one of the Bahamas, and saw 2 or 3 villages. He ended his description of them with these menacing words, 'I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I pleased.'" On his first voyage, Columbus kidnapped some 10 to 25 Indians and took them back with him to Spain. Only 7 or 8 of the Indians arrived alive. But along with the parrots, gold trinkets, and other exotica, they caused quite a stir in Seville. Ferdinand and Isabella provided Columbus with 17 ships, 1,200 to 1,500 men, cannons, crossbows, guns, cavalry, and attack dogs for a second voyage. One way to visualize what happened next is with the help of the famous science fiction story War of the Worlds. H.G. Wells intended his tale of Earthlings' encounter with technologically advanced aliens as an allegory. His frightened British commoners, New Jerseyites in Orson Welles' radio adaptation, were analogous to the primitive peoples of the Canaries or America, and his terrifying aliens represented the technologically advanced Europeans. As we identify with the helpless Earthlings, Wells wanted us also to sympathize with the natives on Haiti in 1493, or Australia in 1788, or the upper Amazon jungle in the 1990s. When Columbus and his men returned to Haiti in 1493, they demanded food, gold, spun cotton, whatever the Indians had that they wanted, including sex with their women. To ensure cooperation, Columbus used punishment by example. When an Indian committed even a minor offense, the Spanish cut off his ears or nose. Disfigured, the person was sent back to his village as living evidence of the brutality the Spaniards were capable of. After a while, the Indians had had enough. At first, their resistance was mostly passive. They refused to plant food for the Spanish to take. They abandoned towns near the Spanish settlements. Finally, the Arawaks fought back. Their sticks and stones were no more effective against the armed and clothed Spanish, however, than the Earthlings' rifles against the aliens' death rays in War of the Worlds. Attempts at resistance gave Columbus an excuse to make war. On March 24, 1495, he set out to conquer the Arawaks. Bartolomé de las Casas described the force Columbus assembled to put down the rebellion. "Since the admiral perceived that daily the people of the land were taking up arms, ridiculous weapons in reality, he hastened to proceed to the country, and disperse and subdue by force of arms the people of the entire island. For this he chose 200 foot soldiers and 20 cavalry, with many crossbows and small cannon, lances and swords, and a still more terrible weapon against the Indians, in addition to the horses. This was 20 hunting dogs who were turned loose and immediately tore the Indians apart." Naturally, the Spanish won. According to Kirkpatrick Sale, who quotes Ferdinand Columbus's biography of his father, "The soldiers mowed down dozens with point-blank volleys, loosed the dogs to rip open limbs and bellies, chased fleeing Indians into the bush to skewer them on sword and pike, and with God's aid soon gained a complete victory, killing many Indians and capturing others who were also killed." Having as yet found no fields of gold, Columbus had to return some kind of dividend to Spain. In 1495, the Spanish on Haiti initiated a great slave raid. They rounded up 1,500 Arawaks, then selected the 500 best specimens, of whom 200 would die en route to Spain. Another 500 were chosen as slaves for the Spaniards staying on the island. The rest were released. A Spanish eyewitness described the event. "Among them were many women who had infants at the breast. They, in order the better to escape us, since they were afraid we would turn to catch them again, left their infants anywhere on the ground and started to flee like desperate people. And some fled so far that they were removed from our settlement of Isabella 7 or 8 days beyond mountains and across huge rivers, wherefore from now on scarcely any will be had." Columbus was excited. "In the name of the Holy Trinity, we can send from here all the slaves in Brazil wood which could be sold," he wrote to Ferdinand and Isabella in 1496. "In Castile, Portugal, Aragon, and the Canary Islands, they need many slaves, and I don't think they can get enough from Guinea." He viewed the Indian death rate optimistically. "Although they die now, they will not always die. The Negroes and Canary Islanders died at first." In the words of Hans Koning, "there now began a reign of terror in Hispaniola. Spaniards hunted Indians for sport and murdered them for dog food. Columbus, upset because he couldn't locate the gold he was certain was on the island, set up a tribute system. Ferdinand Columbus described how it worked. The Indians all promised to pay tribute to the Catholic sovereigns every 3 months, as follows. In the Cibao, where the gold mines were, every person of 14 years of age or upward was to pay a large hawk's bell of gold dust. All others were each to pay 25 pounds of cotton. Whenever an Indian delivered his tribute, he was to receive a brass or copper token, which he must wear about his neck as proof that he had made his payment. Any Indian found without such a token was to be punished. With a fresh token, an Indian was safe for 3 months, much of which time would be devoted to collecting more gold. Columbus's son neglected to mention how the Spanish punished those whose tokens had expired. They cut off their hands. All of these gruesome facts are available in primary source material, letters by Columbus and by other members of his expeditions, and in the work of Las Casas, the first great historian of the Americas, who relied on primary material and helped preserve them. I have quoted a few primary sources in this chapter. Most textbooks make no use of primary sources. A few incorporate brief extracts that have been carefully selected or edited to reveal nothing unseemly about the great navigator. The tribute system eventually broke down because what it demanded was impossible. To replace it, Columbus installed the encomienda system, in which he granted or commended entire Indian villages to individual colonists or groups of colonists. Since it wasn't called slavery, this forced labor system escaped the moral censure that slavery received. Following Columbus's example, Spain made the encomienda system official policy on Haiti in 1502. Other conquistadors subsequently introduced it to Mexico, Peru, and Florida. The tribute and encomienda systems caused incredible depopulation. On Haiti, the colonists made the Indians mine gold for them, raise Spanish food, and even carry them everywhere they went. The Indians couldn't stand it. Pedro de Córdoba wrote in a letter to King Ferdinand in 1517, "As a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians choose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally 100 have committed mass suicide. The women, exhausted by labor, have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands, so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery." Beyond acts of individual cruelty, the Spanish disrupted the Indian ecosystem and culture. Forcing Indians to work in mines rather than their gardens led to widespread malnutrition. The intrusion of rabbits and livestock caused further ecological disaster. Diseases new to the Indians played a role, although smallpox, usually the big killer, didn't appear on the island until after 1516. Some of the Indians tried fleeing to Cuba, but the Spanish soon followed them there. Estimates of Haiti's pre-Columbian population range as high as 8 million people. When Christopher Columbus returned to Spain, he left his brother Bartholomew in charge of the island. Bartholomew took a census of Indian adults in 1496 and came up with 1,100,000. The Spanish didn't count children under 14 and couldn't count Arawaks who had escaped into the mountains. Kirkpatrick Sale estimates that a more accurate total would probably be in the neighborhood of 3 million. By 1516, according to Benjamin Keene, thanks to the sinister Indian slave trade and labor policies initiated by Columbus, only some 12,000 remained. Las Casas tells us that fewer than 200 Indians were alive in 1542. By 1555, they were all gone. Thus, nasty details like cutting off hands have somewhat greater historical importance than nice touches like tierra. Haiti under the Spanish is one of the primary instances of genocide in all human history. Yet only one of the 12 textbooks, the American Pageant, mentions the extermination. None mentions Columbus's role in it. Columbus not only sent the first slaves across the Atlantic, he probably sent more slaves, about 5,000, than any other individual. To her credit, Queen Isabella opposed outright enslavement and returned some Indians to the Caribbean. But other nations rushed to emulate Columbus. In 1501, the Portuguese began to depopulate Labrador, transporting the now extinct Beothuk Indians to Europe and Cape Verde as slaves. After the British established beachheads on the Atlantic coast of North America, they encouraged coastal Indian tribes to capture and sell members of more distant tribes. Charleston, South Carolina, became a major port for exporting Indian slaves. The Pilgrims and Puritans sold the survivors of the Pequot War into slavery in Bermuda in 1637. The French shipped virtually the entire Natchez Nation in chains to the West Indies in 1731. A particularly repellent aspect of the slave trade was sexual. As soon as the 1493 expedition got to the Caribbean, before it even reached Haiti, Columbus was rewarding his lieutenants with native women to rape. On Haiti, sex slaves were one more perquisite that the Spaniards enjoyed. Columbus wrote a friend in 1500, 100 castellanos are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm. And it is very general, and there are plenty of dealers who go about looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 are now in demand. The slave trade destroyed whole Indian nations. Enslaved Indians died. To replace the dying Haitians, the Spanish imported tens of thousands more Indians from the Bahamas, which are now deserted, in the words of the Spanish historian Peter Martyr, reporting in 1516. Packed in below deck, with hatchways closed to prevent their escape, so many slaves died on the trip that a ship without a compass, chart, or guide but only following the trail of dead Indians who had been thrown from the ships, could find its way from the Bahamas to Hispaniola. Puerto Rico and Cuba were next. Because the Indians died, Indian slavery then led to the massive slave trade the other way across the Atlantic, from Africa. This trade also began on Haiti, initiated by Columbus's son in 1505. Predictably, Haiti then became the site of the first large-scale slave revolt when blacks and Indians banded together in 1519. The uprising lasted more than a decade and was finally brought to an end by the Spanish in the 1530s. Of the 12 textbooks, only 6 mention that the Spanish enslaved or exploited the Indians anywhere in the Americas. Of these, only 4 verge on mentioning that Columbus was involved. The United States, A History of the Republic, places the following passage about the fate of the Indians under the heading, The Fate of Columbus. Some Spaniards who had come to the Americas had begun to enslave and kill the original Americans. Authorities in Spain held Columbus responsible for the atrocities. Note that A History takes pains to isolate Columbus from the enslavement charge. Others were misbehaving. Life and Liberty implies that Columbus might have participated. Slavery began in the New World almost as soon as Columbus got off the boat. Only The American Adventure clearly associates Columbus with slavery. American history levels a vague charge. Columbus was a great sailor and a brave and determined man, but he was not good at politics or business. That's it. The other books simply adore him. As Kirkpatrick Sale poetically sums up, Columbus's second voyage marks the first extended encounter of European and Indian societies, the clash of cultures that was to echo down through 5 centuries. The seeds of that 5-century battle were sown in Haiti between 1493 and 1500. These are not mere details that our textbooks omit. They are facts, crucial to understanding American and European history. Captain John Smith, for example, used Columbus as a role model in proposing a get-tough policy for the Virginia Indians in 1624. The manner how to suppress them is so often related and approved, I omit it here. And you have 20 examples of the Spaniards how they got the West Indies and forced the treacherous and rebellious infidels to do all manner of drudgery work and slavery for them, themselves living like soldiers upon the fruits of their labors. The methods unleashed by Columbus are, in fact, the larger part of his legacy. After all, they worked. The island was so well pacified that Spanish convicts, given a second chance on Haiti, could go anywhere, take any woman or girl, take anything, and have the Indians carry him on their backs as if they were mules. In 1499, when Columbus finally found gold on Haiti in significant amounts, Spain became the envy of Europe. After 1500, Portugal, France, Holland, and Britain joined in conquering the Americas. These nations were at least as brutal as Spain. The British, for example, unlike the Spanish, didn't colonize by making use of Indian labor, but simply forced the Indians out of the way. Many Indians fled British colonies to Spanish territories, Florida, Mexico, in search of more humane treatment. Columbus's voyages caused almost as much change in Europe as in the Americas. This is the other half of the vast process historians now call the Columbian Exchange. Crops, animals, ideas, and diseases began to cross the oceans regularly. Perhaps the most far-reaching impact of Columbus's findings was on European Christianity. In 1492, all of Europe was in the grip of the Catholic Church. As LaRousse puts it, before America, Europe was virtually incapable of self-criticism. After America, Europe's religious uniformity was ruptured. for how were these new peoples to be explained? They weren't mentioned in the Bible. The Indians simply didn't fit within the Orthodox Christianity's explanation of the moral universe. Moreover, unlike the Muslims, who might be written off as damned infidels, Indians hadn't rejected Christianity. They had just never encountered it. Were they doomed to hell? Even the animals of America posed a religious challenge. According to the Bible, at the dawn of creation, all animals lived in the Garden of Eden. Later, two of each species entered Noah's Ark and ended up on Mount Ararat. Since Eden and Mount Ararat were both in the Middle East, where could these new American species have come from? Such questions shook Orthodox Catholicism and contributed to the Protestant Reformation, which began in 1517. Politically, nations like the Arawaks, without monarchs, without much hierarchy, stunned Europeans. In 1516, Thomas More's Utopia, based on an account of the Incan Empire in Peru, challenged European social organization by suggesting a radically different and superior alternative. Other social philosophers seized upon the Indians as living examples of Europe's primordial past, which is what John Locke meant by the phrase, "In the beginning, all the world was America." Depending upon their political persuasion, some Europeans glorified Indian nations as examples of simpler, better societies from which European civilization had devolved, while others maligned the Indian societies as primitive and underdeveloped. In either case, from Montaigne, Montesquieu, and Rousseau, down to Marx and Engels, European philosophers' concepts of the good society were transformed by ideas from America. America fascinated the masses as well as the elite. In The Tempest, Shakespeare noted this universal curiosity. "They will not give a doit to relieve a lame beggar. They will lay out 10 to see a dead Indian." Europe's fascination with the Americas was directly responsible, in fact, for a rise in European self-consciousness. From the beginning, America was perceived as an opposite to Europe in ways that even Africa never had been. In a sense, there was no Europe before 1492. People were simply Tuscan, French, and the like. Now Europeans began to see similarities among themselves, at least as contrasted with Native Americans. For that matter, there were no white people in Europe before 1492. With the transatlantic slave trade, first Indian, then African, Europeans increasingly saw white as a race and race as an important human characteristic. Columbus's own writings reflect this increasing racism. When Columbus was selling Queen Isabella on the wonders of the Americas, the Indians were well-built and of quick intelligence. "They have very good customs," he wrote, "and the king maintains a very marvelous state, of a style so orderly that it is a pleasure to see it. And they have good memories, and they wish to see everything, and ask what it is, and for what it is used." Later, when Columbus was justifying his wars and his enslavement of the Indians, they became cruel and stupid, a people warlike and numerous, whose customs and religion are very different from ours. It's always useful to think badly about people one has exploited or plans to exploit. Modifying one's opinions to bring them into line with one's actions or planned actions is the most common outcome of the process known as cognitive dissonance, according to the social psychologist Leon Festinger. No one likes to think of himself or herself as a bad person. To treat badly another person whom we consider a reasonable human being creates a tension between act and attitude that demands resolution. We cannot erase what we have done, and to alter our future behavior may not be in our interest. To change our attitude is easier. Columbus gives us the first recorded example of cognitive dissonance in the Americas, for although the Indians may have changed from hospitable to angry, they could hardly have evolved from intelligent to stupid so quickly. The change had to be in Columbus. The Americas affected more than the mind. African and Eurasian stomachs were also affected. Almost half of all major crops now grown throughout the world originally came from the Americas. According to Alfred Crosby, adding corn to African diets caused the population to grow, which helped fuel the African slave trade to the Americas. Adding potatoes to European diets caused the population to explode in the 16th and 17th century, which in turn helped fuel the European emigration to the Americas and Australia. Crops from America also played a key role in the ascendancy of Britain, Germany, and finally Russia. The rise of these northern nations shifted the power base of Europe away from the Mediterranean. Shortly after ships from Columbus's second voyage returned to Europe, syphilis began to plague Spain and Italy. There is likely a causal connection. On the other hand, more than 200 drugs derived from plants whose pharmacological uses were discovered by American Indians. Economically, exploiting the Americas transformed Europe, enriching first Spain, then through trade and piracy, other nations. Columbus's gold finds on Haiti were soon dwarfed by discoveries of gold and silver in Mexico and the Andes. European religious and political leaders quickly amassed so much gold that they applied gold leaf to the ceilings of their churches and palaces, erected golden statues in the corners, and strung vines of golden grapes between them. Marx and Engels held that this wealth gave to commerce, to navigation, to industry, an impulse never before known. Some writers credit it with the rise of capitalism and eventually the Industrial Revolution. Capitalism was probably already underway, but at the least, American riches played a major role in the transformation. Gold and silver from America replaced land as the basis for wealth and status, increasing the power of the new merchant class that would soon dominate the world. Where Muslim nations had once rivaled Europe, the new wealth undermined Islamic power. American gold and silver fueled a 400% inflation that eroded the economies of most non-European countries and helped Europe to develop a global market system. Africa suffered. The trans-Saharan trade collapsed because the Americas supplied more gold and silver than the Gold Coast ever could. African traders now had only one commodity that Europe wanted: slaves. In anthropologist Jack Weatherford's words, "Africans thus became victims of the discovery of America, as surely as did the American Indians." Astoundingly, not one textbook I surveyed describes these geopolitical implications of Columbus's encounter with the Americas. 3 of the 12 books credit Indians with having developed important crops. Otherwise, the west-to-east flow of ideas and wealth goes unnoticed. Eurocentrism blinds textbook authors to contributions to Europe, whether from Arab astronomers, African navigators, or American Indian social structure. By accepting this limited viewpoint, our history textbooks never invite us to think about what happened to reduce mainland Indian societies, whose wealth and cities awed the Spanish, to the impoverished peasantry they are today. They also rob us of the chance to appreciate how important America has been in the formation of the modern world. This theft impoverishes us, keeps us ignorant of what has caused the world to develop as it has. Clearly, our textbooks are not about teaching history. Their enterprise is building character. They therefore treat Columbus as an origin myth. He was good, and so are we. In 1989, President Bush invoked Columbus as a role model for the nation. "Christopher Columbus not only opened the door to a new world, but also set an example for us all by showing what monumental feats can be accomplished through perseverance and faith. The columnist Jeffrey Hart recently went even further. "To denigrate Columbus is to denigrate what is worthy in human history and in us all." Textbook authors who are pushing Columbus to build character obviously have no interest in mentioning what he did with the Americas once he reached them, even though that's half the story and perhaps the more important half. I'm not proposing the breast-beating alternative that Columbus was bad and so are we. On the contrary, textbooks should show that neither morality nor immorality can simply be conferred upon us by history. Merely being part of the United States, without regard to our own acts and ideas, does not make us moral or immoral beings. History is more complicated than that. Again, we must pause to consider, who are we? Columbus is not a hero in Mexico, even though Mexico is much more Spanish in culture than the United States, and might be expected to take pride in this hero of Spanish history. Why not? Because Mexico is also much more Indian than the United States, and Mexicans perceive Columbus as white and European. "No sensible Indian person," wrote George P. Horsecapture, "can celebrate the arrival of Columbus." Cherishing Columbus is a characteristic of white history, not American history. Columbus's conquest of Haiti can be seen as an amazing feat of courage and imagination by the first of many brave empire builders. It can also be understood as a bloody atrocity that left a legacy of genocide and slavery that endures in some degree to this day. Both views of Columbus are valid. Indeed, Columbus's importance in history owes precisely to his being both a heroic navigator and a great plunderer. If Columbus were only the former, he would merely rival Leif Erikson. Columbus's actions exemplify both meanings of the word exploit, a remarkable deed and also a taking advantage of. The worshipful biographical vignettes of Columbus in our textbooks serve to indoctrinate students into a mindless endorsement of colonialism that is strikingly inappropriate in today's post-colonial era. In the words of historian Michael Wallace, the Columbus myth allows us to accept the contemporary division of the world into developed and underdeveloped spheres as natural and given, rather than a historical product issuing from a process that began with Columbus's first voyage. We understand Columbus and all European explorers and settlers more clearly if we treat 1492 as a meeting of three cultures. Africa was soon involved, rather than a discovery by one. The term New World is itself part of the problem, for people had lived in the Americas for thousands of years. The Americas were new only to Europeans. The word discover is another part of the problem, for how can one person discover what another already knows and owns? Our textbooks are struggling with this issue, trying to move beyond colonialized history and Eurocentric language. If Columbus had not discovered the New World, states Land of Promise, others soon would have. Three sentences later, the authors try to take back the word. As is often pointed out, Columbus did not really discover America. When he arrived on this side of the Atlantic, there were perhaps 20 or more million people already here. Taking back words is ineffectual, however. Promise's whole approach is to portray whites discovering non-whites rather than a mutual, multicultural encounter. The point isn't idle. Words are important. They can influence and in some cases rationalize policy. In 1823, Chief Justice John Marshall of the United States Supreme Court decreed that Cherokees had certain rights to their land in Georgia by dint of their occupancy, but that whites had superior rights owing to their discovery. How Indians managed to occupy Georgia without having previously discovered it, Marshall neglected to explain. The process of exploration has itself typically been multiracial and multicultural. William Erasmus, a Canadian Indian, pointed out, "Explorers you call great men were helpless. They were like lost children, and it was our people who took care of them. African pilots helped Prince Henry's ship captains learn their way down the coast of Africa. On Christmas Day 1492, Columbus needed help. The Santa Maria ran aground off Haiti. Columbus sent for help to the nearest Arawak town, and all the people of the town responded, with very big and many canoes. They cleared the decks in a very short time," Columbus continued, "and the chief caused all our goods to be placed together near the palace, until some houses that he gave us, where all might be put and guarded, had been emptied." On his final voyage, Columbus shipwrecked on Jamaica, and the Arawaks there kept him and his crew of more than 100 alive for a whole year until Spaniards from Haiti rescued them. So it has continued. Native Americans cured Cartier's men of scurvy near Montreal in 1535. They repaired Francis Drake's Golden Hind in California so he could complete his round-the-world voyage in 1579. Lewis and Clark's expedition to the Pacific Northwest was made possible by tribe after tribe of American Indians, with help from two Shoshone guides, Sacagawea and Toby, who served as interpreters. When Admiral Parry discovered the North Pole, the first person there was probably neither European-American Parry nor the African-American Matthew Henson, his assistant, but their four Inuit guides, men and women on whom the entire expedition relied. Our histories fail to mention such assistants. They portray proud Western conquerors bestriding the world like the Colossus at Rhodes. So long as our textbooks hide from us the roles that people of color have played in exploration, from at least 6,000 B.C. to the 20th century, they encourage us to look to Europe and its extensions as the seat of all knowledge and intelligence. So long as our textbooks simply celebrate Columbus rather than teach both sides of his exploit, they encourage us to identify with white Western exploitation rather than study it. The first passage I'm about to read is one of the many legends that hang about Columbus like barnacles. Myths, all without substance. The second passage I'm about to read is part of a contemporaneous account of an Arawak cacique, leader, who had fled from Haiti to Cuba. First passage. A man riding a mule moved slowly down a dusty road in Spain. He wore an old and shabby cloak over his shoulders. Though his face seemed young, his red hair was already turning white. It was early in the year 1492 when Christopher Columbus was leaving Spain. Twice the Spanish king and queen had refused his request for ships. He had wasted 5 years of his life trying to get their approval. Now he was going to France. Perhaps the French king would give him the ships he needed. Columbus heard a clattering sound. He turned and looked up the road. A horse and rider came racing toward him. The rider handed him a message, and Columbus turned his mule around. The message was from the Spanish king and queen, ordering him to return. Columbus would get his ships. Second passage. Learning that Spaniards were coming, one day the cacique gathered all his people together to remind them of the persecutions which the Spanish had inflicted on the people of Hispaniola. "Do you know why they persecute us?" they replied. "They do it because they are cruel and bad." "I will tell you why they do it," the cacique stated, "and it is this, because they have a lord whom they love very much, and I will show him to you." He held up a small basket made from palms full of gold, and he said, "Here is their lord, whom they serve and adore. To have this lord they make us suffer. For him they persecute us. For him they have killed your parents, brothers, all our people. Let us not hide this Lord from the Christians in any place, for even if we should hide it in our intestines, they will get it out of us. Therefore, let us throw it in this river, under the water, and they will not know where it is." Whereupon they threw the gold into the river. You may have already guessed that the first passage comes from an American.